And welcome to another edition of Talking History. I'm Jerry Zahavi, and this is a special show. It's a pleasure to have two guests with us live in our studios today. And our subject is going to be the history of labor-management relations, but focusing more on management and the evolution in American capitalism of different approaches to managing workers. And I first want to introduce Hal Harris, Professor Hal Harris. He is a professor of history at Durham University up in northern England. He was born in Wales, in northern Wales, in a town which I will not try to pronounce. I'll let him let you know. Lived there for a while, went to a number of universities in England before he settled down at Durham University. He's the author of two books and an editor of a third book. The first book, Right to Manage, came out in 1982, and it looks at industrial relations policies in the 1940s in the United States. And his second book was published recently, I believe in 2000, was it? 2000? It's called Bloodless Victories, The Rise and Fall of the Open Shop in the Philadelphia Metal Trades, 1890 to 1940. And a third book was edited with Nelson Lichtenstein, Industrial Democracy, The Ambiguous Promise. And that also came out in 2000. And also with us is Chad Pearson. He's a doctoral student at the University of Albany working on employer associations. He's working on a dissertation which focuses on that topic, looking at three communities and the growth of employer associations in Cleveland, in Buffalo, and in Worcester, Massachusetts. So welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I would like to start our discussion today asking Howell how he got interested in labor history and business history in the first place, and what drew him to this field.
Thanks, Jerry. It was a development, really, of an interest simply in what happened, what became of the New Deal in American politics. First of all, I thought that what I wanted to look at was the kind of the conservatizing of American politics from the 30s through the 40s. And then as you do, I narrowed it down. Then I thought what I would do as an aspect of that is I'd look at the kind of the containment of the American labor movement from the great upsurge of the late 1930s to its post-war inclusion within a democratic consensus. And it's just as well I didn't do that, because unbeknown to me, Nelson Lichtenstein was doing it at exactly the same time, and we were only about 5,000 miles apart. Anyway, I came to America to pursue that, and I was working at Cornell and in Detroit, and I came to the conclusion pretty rapidly that if you wanted to understand the change in American labor relations in the 30s and 40s, the place to look wasn't just, and maybe wasn't even mainly, the labor movement. The important thing was to look at what business was doing, to look at business's successful response to the challenge of the New Deal and the problems of dealing with an organized labor force. A response at many levels, national politics, public relations, articulating a clear conservative ideological message, and doing everything within the factory, within the plant, within their own sphere, in order to get back in control. And that was the work that I did for my doctorate, and that turned into The Right to Manage, which I think it's, he said, immodestly, I think it's still the best thing around on that, really.
Well, it did win the Philip Taft Prize back in 1983, I believe.
It did, indeed.
So
yeah.
A lot of people acknowledge that it's an excellent work, and yeah. I think it is. I've used it in a number of my classes.
Yeah, I just wish more people had bought it.
I wanted to go back to my question, though. What is it that drew you to the study of this subject in the first place? I mean, do you come from a working class family? Were your parents always discussing topics of
not at all
of labor and capital? And
No. My father was it's a very rural background. Small farmer, slaughterman, butcher. And he ended up, after military service, he got a white-collar job, a clerk in a farm auction house. And my mother cleaned other people's houses as well as our own. And So it wasn't a working class. It was, I suppose you could say, it was certainly not an industrial working class home. Village of a couple of hundred people and very, very provincial. But we are made by our times to a considerable extent, and my focus on labor relations was kind of natural in Britain in the late 60s and through the mid-1970s, because at that time we did have a very, very powerful labor movement. There was an acknowledged problem of industrial conflict, of inadequate productivity in Britain, and there was a succession of responses to it at a public policy level by governments through the 1970s. Our conservative government in the early 1970s basically imported what they thought of as the best bits of Taft-Hartley, of the 1947 fundamental law of American labor relations. And the labor government responded in the late 1970s with a hope of imitating other bits of American labor relations. The kind of orderly contractual labor relations that you saw still at that time in manufacturing industry, in the system of what David Brody, the great American labor historian, calls workplace contractualism. So when I was a graduate student and then an academic, you know, finishing my first book in the 1970s, in the background in my own country, there was a series of major political issues that has made one aware that in the United States things were done differently, and that it was worthwhile to study. So I didn't come to this from a position of kind of personal politics, but on the other hand, the American model was in the background in British kind of thinking in the 1970s. So it was natural to kind of play against that.
Well, we'll get back to that American model toward the end of the show. But what I'd like to do is organize our discussion and around really chronologically and go back to the 19th century and look at employer organizations and what the relationship was like between workers and managers in America in the 19th century and how it changed as with the growth of national trade unions in the late 19th century. So why don't you take us there, Hal? And then we'll join you as we trace this evolution. We've focused on workers a lot on this show, but this is an opportunity for us to focus on employers, on capital. It strikes me we start in the early 19th century without great divisions between labor and capital in this country.
That's fair enough. Though I'd look at it a slightly different way. And that is from almost as soon as you begin to get in the formation of kind of fragments, local fragments of what would turn into trade unions in the 1830s and in the 1840s, and particularly in the 1850s. You only have to wait weeks or months after the first organizations on workers' part before employers begin to get together the same way. I mean, actually, pardon me, to a considerable extent, I think that the American trade union movement has been a powerful educator for American employers, not simply in the necessity of self-organization, but in the ways of doing it, too. American employers, they have been, you know, they are individualistic. They are focused on their own business. 19th century employers and managers, you're mostly dealing with people who own and run their own show. They have very, very little clerical help. They're extremely busy men. They have no time to spare really for things that they think are of really no significance. So if you don't have a labor relations problem, you do nothing about it. On the other hand, as soon as you do have a labor relations problem, individualism goes out of the window, and there's a complete readiness from the 1870s on, well, 1850s, 60s on, at the local level and in particular industries, to respond to the challenge of labor. What happens, of course, over time is that challenge becomes more serious.
But when we look at the first part of the 19th century, and Chad, feel free to chime in. It strikes me that we're talking about, except for the textile industry, we're talking about small factories. We're not talking about these huge mega production establishment or mega works that we see today or late 19th, 20th century and today. But we're talking about smaller shops where managers and workers knew each other. Are we not talking about that, except for the textile industry?
Well, they might know one another, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they get on terribly well. They have different interests, and they acknowledge that their interests are different.
But certainly there are times when the employees expect that sometime at some point they will make their way up to the position of manager or
Oh, sure, and it does happen, so that, you know, one's not talking about rigid class lines in any respect. What it is, I think, in another way of thinking about it, is simply that you're dealing with two communities that are actually close to one another, but where there are very, very great differences of power and interest between them, but actually not a huge amount of difference in terms of ideology and values. It doesn't mean that their relations are good, but it does mean that they can speak the same language. Eventually, they can speak the same language of bargaining. Or, of course, they can speak the same language of organizing yourself to look after your own interests and using whatever resources is at their hand.
Now, the exceptional case, of course, in early industrial America is the textile industry, communities like Lowell and the Boston Manufacturing Company. And they sort of anticipated a lot of the developments in late 19th and early 20th century, I think. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, to an extent. I mean, they do have problems of management on a large scale. And I suppose where they're most interested is in terms of their experiments in what would later, much later, come to be thought of as welfare capitalism. That's the provision of a range of social services, you might say, for employers, turning the company into more than just an employer for a community of workers, but actually into a kind of a focus of their lives. But there are very, very few companies that have either the scale or the means or the interest to do that in the 19th century. The second great exception really begins to kick in the 1860s, 1870s, and that's the railroads. They're not dealing with settled communities of workers and with overwhelmingly young and female workers like the textile industry. They're dealing with skilled and unskilled adult male workers, but even so, they're dealing with them by the hundreds and thousands, and they have to do it systematically. But leaving those two exceptions aside, you're right. I mean, right through the late 19th century, what one's dealing with mostly is small to middle-sized enterprises managed by the people who own them. And that complicates matters. You emphasized that it could produce a kind of a face-to-face relationship. Well, yes, it could. But it also complicates matters because it means that employers are really invested in the ownership of their own business. And the protection of the rights of ownership, the right to control, is something about which they become very emotional, which means that they can be prepared both to make significant investments and sacrifices in holding on to that control, or they can actually behave somewhat irrationally when that control is challenged. And that means that in small and medium-sized enterprises, these are not places that are without really quite severe and often bitter industrial conflict. It's just that they're not very big. They don't register on the national earthquake monitoring scale in the way that conflicts in the iron and steel or the railroad industry do, but they're happening all over the place.
Now, in the 19th century, you see the formation of national trade unions, the Knights of St. Crispin, the Knights of Labor, the American Federation of Labor. We talked a little bit off before we went on the air about the sort of dialectic between larger worker organizations and employer organizations. Can you talk a little bit about, and again, both of you, about the development of employer organizations in the late 19th century?
The National Founders Association, which began in 1897, this is a group that one of the first employer associations to deal almost exclusively with labor questions. emerges in out of what's called the American Foundry Association, which was a technical group. In any event, the National Founders Association is looking at the labor unions as to how they organize, primarily the Iron Molders Union, and sees how aggressive they are, sees how well organized they are, and they read their literature and in some ways want to emulate them.
Mm. Yeah, the John Penton, who's the primary organizer of the National Founders Association, he's a former trade union leader himself. He'd been a trade union leader and a skilled workman until 1892, and then you might say he crossed the line. He became an entrepreneur, but he took his skills with him. And you find him referred in the literature at the time as the foundryman's business agent. The language that's used to describe what employers are doing in their own interests is the language of the trade union movement. There's another nice parallel to that. There's an organization that still exists, a very powerful business pressure and research group called the Conference Board. The name Conference Board and the idea of conference boards was taken, similarly, from Skilled Workers Union, from the Iron Molders Union, which organized its locals into conference boards for, well, for local level bargaining. An extremely effective employer organizer in the 1900s was quite impressed by that model and thought employers should do the same. So he set up conference boards of employers that handled particular questions, notably industrial safety. That's in the 1900s, late into the teens. His name was Magnus Alexander. He worked for General Electric, which is quite a big player in the Albany, Schenectady, Troy area. And out of those early conference boards, the national board grew. So this theme of kind of responsive self-organization is one that one can find at the local level, the industrial level, even the national level, right, I would say, from about the 1860s onwards.
When we talk about the growth of working class consciousness in the 19th century, can we also talk very much about, or in a similar way, about the growth of employer class consciousness, of capital class consciousness in these organizations?
I'm absolutely sure that we can, yes.
I think we can, but they certainly never admit to it publicly. They are opposed to anything relating to class, or at least the language of class. Mm. They say, you know, they're opposed to what they call class legislation. And
they're opposed to class legislation, but on the other hand, they're entirely clear that they have interests as a class. The trick is that with American employers, a part of their enduring success, I suppose you could say, is that from the time that employer power was first challenged in a big way in the 1860s and 1870s, American employers have responded that they do not have class interests because their interests are the interests of the nation. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very successful identification of the interests of a group with that of the society as a whole. And that identification has been believable, I'd argue, to certainly a majority of middle-class Americans since it was first made. And that's been an enormous mountain for the American labor movement to have to climb up from time to time to win the sympathy and support of the independent middle class. It's a hard task, and most of the time it fails.
Well, doesn't the existence of employer organizations or associations belie that? I mean, suggest that, in fact, that they do have an interest group mentality of classmen.
Yeah, but it's not just an interest group mentality. One of the things that interests me about American employers is looking at the other things they do apart from employ people and create enterprises. They create clubs. They create charitable foundations. They have really an intense middle to upper middle class enclosed social life of their own. And historians might not look at employer communities using the tools of social history very much, but when they do, it's actually quite rewarding, because what you find is the same kind of multiple bonds, not just of intimate of interest, but of sentiment, of friendship, that tie these groups together. And one of the things that comes through clearly in employers' associations' histories, and it's something that their organizers are very aware of, is the importance of simply the development of friendship. Friendship, acquaintanceship, loyalty. Because when push comes to shove, if you can depend on personal connections as well as simply interest, then you're more likely to hang together.
The other thing is that many of these employers are setting up groups that are called citizens associations, and these are more inclusive groups. Although they're led by employers and they're anti-union, they boast that their members come from all walks of life, doctors, lawyers, including ordinary workers.
Isn't that a 20th century phenomenon, though, more than the 19th century, the citizens?
Early 20th century it begins, but...
During the progressive era.
Yes,
partially in a response, isn't it, to the criticism of progressives as, treating them as interests, as a selfish interest group.
Yeah, so you can kind of shelter behind the notion of, the interests of a local community. But it's not... It's a kind of a shelter that is believable to many independent local business people, because one of the things that we need to be aware of is that in towns and cities across the United States, the most numerous members of the middle class and business community are not employers of industrial labor. They're owners of small local businesses, service enterprises, finance houses, local papers. There's that kind of local business class that's hardly involved directly in industrial labor relations at all. In many respects, I think that is actually, the community, that's the public, that these sorts of civic organizations exist to mobilize and to keep united with the larger industrial employers in those kinds of communities, to make the local middle class realize that the interests of the larger employers and that of the prosperity and the growth of the community as a whole are as one. And that's an identification that is very easy to make, and it's one of enduring importance. You can see it right through to the present in terms of the sensitivity of local chambers of commerce to creating what is thought of as a good business climate for investment and job creation within them. And one of the important indicators of a good business climate is the adequacy of the labor supply. And nowadays, of course, the existence of, no labor union or regulatory threat. That's something that one can more or less take for granted now. But it's something that's been quite a significant achievement, reconstructing that in the post-Second World War era.
But part of that it was constructed in an evolutionary way, because there was a major crisis that takes place in late 19th century America with the explosion of the working class in a series of Pullman strike, strikes against, beginning with 1877 with the general strike in the railroad industry.
Absolutely.
Businessmen are in a crisis. First of all, they're being perceived as exploiters in the late 19th century, and with the social gospel movement criticizing them, with the progressives criticizing them. And so there's a sort of a crisis of legitimacy that takes place. And how do they respond to that in terms of responding to it, but yet retaining control? Because you emphasize the role of control, the importance of control, even from the early 19th century. What happens then? How do they respond then, and how does that change over time?
Okay, that's an interesting question. Because
it's a broad one, too.
It's a broad one, but let's try and tie it down to, say, Chicago in the 1890s, early 1900s, particularly after the Pullman strike and the Great Railroad boycott, after the Homestead strike, too. And you look at a city like Chicago in the late 19th century, a huge immigrant working class population, actually for the time a vibrant labor movement. And you're right, a serious kind of doubt by local middle class people that the kinds of labor relations that exist in American industry at the time are tolerable or sustainable. And the response by American employers and by Chicago employers to that is not simply, in the short term, it's not even mainly, I think, to organize for more effective conflict. It's to try and think about ways of softening the edges of that conflict. So you get the creation of a thing called the Chicago Civic Federation, which is designed to narrow class divisions, you get experiments by individual employers in quite simply treating their employees better. And those developments run in parallel with the Organization for Conflict for more effective confrontation with trade unions that we see in particular from the early 1900s and that Chad is interested in at the moment. And I think that one needs to tie these two strands together and really never lose sight of both of them from then onwards. One of the ways in which the crisis of labor relations, the crisis of industrial relations of the late 19th century is dealt with is quite simply by the improvement in the ways in which American businesses handle their workers. To use modern language, the demand for the services, for the representation, for the, for the defense of rights that trade unions offer workers, the demand for those services can be reduced by employers in providing some of them first, providing them themselves, doing it better. And that's something that one can see quite clearly from the 1890s in quite a big way. So these, what one might think of as the enlightened self-interest of liberal capital and the readiness to resort to force if need be, these are not separate themes, they intertwine from the 1890s through the 1930s.
Let me just add something. In Dayton, Ohio, where some say the modern open shop movement, that is the movement against organized labor, they had a motto about how to deal with the workforce. And their motto was, do right, then fight.
Yep.
Meaning if you know their employees did not respond positively or gave them a hard time, they saw themselves as employers as doing the right thing, and they would respond violent, or, you know, however they thought necessary if they had a fight on their hands.
Yeah. We're gonna be taking a short break now. Just want to remind our listeners that we are airing a live Talking History today, a conversation with historian Hal Harris from Durham University and Chad Pearson, the graduate student, doctoral student at the University at Albany, and also a union organizer at Communication Workers of America.